Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. At the age of 90, John Freely has written of his adventures in war, science, teaching, and world travel in a memoir from Knopf called The House of Memory, Reflections on Youth and War. Mr. Freely is the author of over 60 other books on topics ranging from biographical figures to the history of science, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show now. Welcome here, and you braved this terrible weather?
No, I actually got a quarter of an hour shoveling sidewalks in New York for this.
During the Depression when...
See, we were aspiring working class. I once asked my mother, are we working class? So you would be working class if your father could find work.
Yes, so that was after you say you heard Roosevelt mention that in one of his fireside chats. He talked about the working class. But your mother said if we only were working...
We were aspiring working class.
You say it's taken you a long time to write this memoir, which you originally imagined writing 70 years ago. There have been an awful lot of books in between. I wonder how you've written
I spent age 5 to 7 in the Dingle Peninsula in the west of Ireland. My four grandparents, only one could read and write. And one of my distant kinsmen, Morris O'Sullivan, wrote a book called... 20 years of growing. He couldn't speak English. He couldn't read or write. It was taken down and published in Irish and English. And 20 years of growing, 20 years of blossom, 20 years of stoop, and 20 years declining. Such is the life of man. So when I first read that, I thought, I will do the same thing. And when the first form that it took, when I just came back from the war, a month before my 20th birthday, I said, I will start doing the book. So it marinated all through the years. And then I finally... finished it quite a few years ago, and then nobody was interested, so I put it away in a filing cabinet. Now, what's his name? Arthur Kessler once said, a writer's unpublished manuscript in a filing cabinet is a writer's equivalent of a corpse under the floorboard.
So finally opened up the floorboards and...
Well, actually, I got in touch with a wonderful agent, Gillian McKenzie, and she said, what do you have? Well, I said, God. So I took it out and whacked it a couple of times. The dust came out of it, and we straightened it up, and... the business of memory is a very strange thing because you don't want the present seeping into the past at all. And of course, Schopenhauer said that we sort of craft our memories to create our identity.
So were you surprised by some of the things you found when you looked at that manuscript?
No, actually, because I've been going over it in my head for years and years.
Well, let's go back. You were born in Brooklyn in 1926. How long after your parents had moved to the United States?
Well, actually, my mother and father were Irish immigrants who met, married, and conceived me in Boston. And then when she was fired, they took me down to New York, and my father got a job as a trolley car conductor of the Canarsie-Williamsburg Bridge Line. And my mother tells me she used to take, on a nice day, he'd ring his bell, and she'd take me out, we'd ride to the Williamsburg Bridge and back again. But I don't remember that. We left America when I was 4 and a half. I have no memories of America. So I'm growing up in an Ireland place where they're speaking a different language.
The Dingle Peninsula in Ireland. And you say that almost everyone didn't speak English. They were all speaking Gaelic?
They were all speaking Irish. And hardly anyone. In fact, my maternal grandmother could speak English, but my grandfather, too. He couldn't read or write. So it was completely... everything was based on memory.
But your grandfather, Thomas Murphy, is still known on the Dingle Peninsula as Tom of the Winds because he was such a great storyteller. So that was one of your inspirations, the other being some of the books you found in your grandparents' attic?
Well, my great-grandfather had fought in the Crimean War. He couldn't read or write, but he got a book of gravures. It was called A Pictorial Voyage Around the World, a voyage up to Limpopo, a voyage across the American West by rail. And so that put the idea in my head of traveling, particularly to Constantinople.
You have taught in Istanbul, Constantinople used to be, for 50 years.
I was still teaching there a year and a half ago.
Wow.
History of science, physics, astronomy.
How did you wind up there? Well, as an English speaker who may know some Irish.
Well, because I had wanted from the time I was a child. He had been there in 1856 during the Crimean War, so I thought I want to go there. So anyway, when I came back from the war, I had dropped out of high school to join the Navy, and after the war, we were all engaged in self-destructive activities. So I met this very beautiful girl, and I thought, my God, I've got to do something. So I went to college on the GI Bill, and then
Iona.
Iona, yeah.
And then you went to what, NYU?
Well, actually, I didn't. I got a job as a research physicist at the U.S. Army Signal Corps Laboratory. I was right in the middle of the McCarthy era, and then a job at Princeton. Meanwhile, going to graduate school at NYU at night.
Now, okay, let's back up again. You were in Ireland. How did you return to the United States? Mostly living in Brooklyn?
Well, everything was Brooklyn because my father, at times, he was a trolley car conductor, longshoreman, manual laborer. Anyway, so he finally...
He was a grave digger for part of the time to make a living.
Yeah, all of his life, yeah. But the thing is that he got a job, and then we came back from Ireland, and by the time we got back, he'd lost the job, so he had to turn around and go back again.
And your mother, you say, worked nights cleaning offices in Rockefeller Center.
Yeah, right.
And you, by the time you were in high school, well, first you went to parochial school, but then you went to Brooklyn Tech.
Brooklyn Tech, yeah.
And you were delivering the Brooklyn Eagle. You worked after school and on Saturdays in a paint factory, and then as a stock clerk in a drug supply factory, and you sold, among other things, packaged condoms. Good Catholic boy? Was it because your mother was an atheist?
I was a third-generation atheist. We packaged them, but we didn't actually see them. Mm. But the thing is that my principal source of income was scavenging, rag and bones and so forth. It was wonderful.
And bring them to the junkyard?
I'm sorry?
What were you scavenging them for, to sell?
To sell them for junk. We got 2 cents a pound, 2 cents a 100 pound on papers and brass and copper and broken down radios and so forth. And sometimes, those nice old brownstone houses you go by and the doorknob would be a little loose. You'd take it and put it away in the...
So that lasted until the end of the Depression.
Well, actually, the Depression for us never quite ended.
So is that why you enlisted in the U.S. Navy in 1944 when you were just 17?
Yeah, well, see, the thing is, I was because I was working nights and weekends, I couldn't keep up with my studies. The only course I passed was literature. The idea was that I was fixated by homework. So I thought if I can get in the Navy, I might... go across his tracks, and I did quite a bit.
And you say you were afraid that the war would end before you got a chance to enlist. So Homer and other things led you to romanticize the war. But then you didn't find the war to be all that pleasant. In fact, you describe war as hell on earth.
Well, I'd say my war was very interesting because I was in an elite commando unit who was not attached to the Chinese army. It was a clandestine army of Chinese soldiers, 100,000 of them. They accounted for more Japanese than did Mao or Chiang Kai-shek. And it was called the Loyal and Patriotic Army of China. And there were 100,000 troops, but most of them were for the Tibetan borderlands of China. They couldn't speak Chinese at all. They're from matrilineal societies.
So you wound up near Tibet?
Yunnan province, yes.
Now, you said Mao and Chiang Kai-shek. Were you aware of that this was kind of the lead-up to the Chinese Civil War?
Well, actually, I was involved in the first day of the Chinese Civil War, because when the war ended on the 2nd of September 1945, I was all by myself in the headquarters of the Chinese First Army Group, and myself and my companion, Ching Ying Chu, we celebrated the end of the war. And then about 2 hours later, we had machine gun bullets bursting through our tent. It was the Chinese Civil War just started. We're in the middle of it.
What was your journey along the Lido-Stillwell Road like?
It was quite extraordinary because when we went from San Pedro, California to Calcutta by way of Australia, and then they put us in trucks in Calcutta, and we went on barges of the Assam Railway all the way up to within sight of Tibet, and then down through along the Burma Road, along the Salween River, just as the great battle of the Salween Gorge is finishing. There are 120,000 Chinese and Japanese troops have been killed in that war. Mm. We caught just the last day of it.
And you passed through a military cemetery while you were in the Navy.
Actually, just exactly when we went on the Burma Road, we passed the cemetery, and a black sergeant said what that was.
And that was a shocker to you?
A shock. Well, my father's a gravedigger, so I'm used to people being buried and put slowly. It was just dumping those poor young men in the grave.
While you were on watch one night, you heard a young Japanese soldier crying or yelling.
Well, actually, we were put on guard duty. It was in Mongyu, the last day of the Battle of the Salween River Gorge, and myself and my friend Gene Tunney, spaced about 50 yards apart, and between us was
not the G. Tunney, the boxer.
Well, actually, he was Gene Tunney used to box at his father's farm, so that's where the name came from. But anyway, and between us was a Kashin scout. The Kashins, when they kill a Japanese, they cut his right ear off. And so halfway through our watch in the middle of the night, I heard a screaming to my left, and then I heard this gurgling sound. He had cut his throat, and the next morning we found it was just a 17-year-old emaciated kid. So a great shock. But then we, a week or two later, we were marooned by the monsoon. And I was put out, a convoy was strung out for many miles, and I was put out on the road with a flashlight to wave people into the Chinese army camp. And then finally, to protect myself, I rolled under the truck. And the next morning I wake up, and somebody's nudging me from under the tailgate of the truck, and a big black American quartermaster sergeant says, "Wake up, soldier, the war's over."
You're listening to New York Public Radio at WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope, speaking to John Freely, whose book, The House of Memory, Reflections on Youth and War, is published by Knopf. You mentioned that you had been inspired by Homer, by Odyssey. Did you think of yourself when you started traveling all over the world as a kind of a modern-day Odysseus?
Well, actually, by all means, yes. And in my life, I published a book on Homer about 3 years ago. I have been everywhere that Homer, that Odysseus was, including, in fact, I read Homer before I went to war, but I read it in Richard Chapman's translation of 1597. And on the way back from the war in China, we went the other way around, and we passed through the Suez Canal and then out into the Mediterranean. And we passed the southern tip of Crete, and I remember this wonderful line from Homer by Chapman: "In the middle of the sable sea, there lies an isle called Crete, a ravisher of eyes." Mm.
You've written over 60 books. You know, how did you have time to travel and write books at the same time?
Well, because I was living in Istanbul, but we also lived in Athens. We also lived in Venice, but we in those days travel was very cheap, and we traveled with our children. You know, hotels were $2-3 a night. And
now, you mentioned that you went to college. You got postdoctoral work at All Souls College in Oxford after you went to NYU. And you studied nuclear physics. How did that come out of all these experiences?
Well, I was always interested in science, but my PhD is in physics, but at Oxford I studied history of science.
You also tell the sad story that your wife, Dolores, who you call Toots, died on your wedding anniversary?
On 64th wedding anniversary, yes.
Wow. Now, they've named a building after you at Bosphorus College in Istanbul.
It's the John Freely Cultural Center. It's a very funny story about it. When I was 80, they renamed my lecture room the John Freely Seminar Room. And a friend of my daughter's from Harvard, Alkis Duxiatis, came through, and a young graduate student woman met him at the airport, and she said, "I'm hoping to see John Freely." And she said, "Oh, sir, John Freely is not a person, it's a room."
You've divided this memoir into three sections, Youth, War, and Memory, but the title is House of Memory. What do you think of as the house of memory?
Well, see, the Greeks, the Irish have a memory as a pool of memory. And you dip in the pool, think of the Greeks being more organized. To remember things, you remember this room goes love and that room goes sadness. And memories you really want to bury, you put down in the basement and lock the door. Let's see, all my life I've been fascinated by memory. There are books called The Palace of Memory, The House of Memory. Mm-hmm. I've been fascinated by how memory of things changes over time.
Well, you're 90 years old. There are some things that just have to have been lost over the years.
Not at all. I don't think I've ever...
You can recall pretty much everything?
I have no delete button in my...
Well, it's all there in everybody's brain. It's just harder for some people to bring it back.
Well, mostly because I don't get into it. But once you see, living in a nursing home now, my average age is 90.
You're in Bath, in England?
In Bath, yes. And I'm developing a relationship now with a 93-year-old lady. Uh-huh. It's not going far because we're both kind of deaf. But they have not reexamined their memories. I've been reexamining my memories all my life. And, you know, people say...
Because you've been writing. And the writing kind of makes it permanent for you?
Well, that's right, because then it gets fixed and then I don't have to think about it anymore. But the thing is that I've done 5 books since I've been in the nursing home because I have nothing else. I have no day job now. But people say, are you Irish? Are you American? I'm from Brooklyn. That's my identity was formed.
Do you ever go back?
In 66 years, I have not been back. And I'm hoping to go with this damn snow maybe tomorrow.
Because you'll find it's changed a lot.
Oh, I will, yeah, indeed. You know, I had a dear friend once, about 5 years older than me, a very prominent Jewish scholar from my part of Brooklyn. I said, have you been back? He said, I'd be terrified to meet my 17-year-old self.
No, me too. I grew up in Williamsburg.
Where did you grow up?
I actually lived on Broadway with the elevated train going by in Williamsburg.
Oh, of course, when I lived, the Broadway L was wonderful.
Yeah. Still there.
Oh, yeah, but you were in Williamsburg, yeah.
Yeah. Moved all around the borough. But that's when I write my book. I'll write a memoir someday. But everyone should know that you will be reading from your book and signing tomorrow night at 6 at the Corner Bookstore on Madison Avenue and 93rd Street. The book, The House of Memory, Reflection on Youth and War, published by Knopf. It's been a great pleasure having you here, and considering the hardship of getting here and in this terrible weather, I really do appreciate being able to see you and talk to you face to face.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Yeah.
Back in the 1970s and 80s, stories of police corruption and collusion with the mob became big headline news. But over the last several years, there's been relatively few scandals, and many people assume that this type of behavior was no longer of much concern. But a new series called NYPD Inc. by Robert Lewis, a George Polk Award-winning reporter at this station, reveals how some members of the upper ranks of the NYPD engage in practices that could be seen as potential conflicts of interest and even to ties to organized crime. I'm very pleased that Robert Lewis could join us now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
This series revolves around how many police officers make money outside of the NYPD. What are the NYPD's rules about outside jobs and income?
Well, so they require officers to file some sort of application to take a secondary employment. And then after that, I mean, assuming it gets approved, that's pretty much it. There are some basic rules regarding the types of employment. There's a certain classification. They can't be locksmiths. They can't work at a bar or an establishment that serves alcohol. And then after that, there is a small subset of officers, really, the top ones, who are required to file financial disclosure forms with the City Conflicts of Interest Board.
And that only applies to 130 top NYPD personnel. So why only 130?
Well, city law, the rules regarding conflicts of interest require basically any city officials, not just the PD, who can either set policy or make spending decisions to file these disclosures. And this is what the NYPD has determined meets that sort of criteria.
How does that compare to police departments elsewhere in the country?
It's significantly less. I looked at some departments like Chicago, which requires has a sort of a blanket requirement that anyone rank of, I believe it's lieutenant and above, to file a disclosure form with that city's Board of Ethics. If that were applied in New York, that would apply to 2,500 officers as opposed to the 130 you referenced. And I mean, to be fair, a sort of side point, the forms that we have here, the oversight here in New York, does appear to be much more serious, much stricter. The form that, is at least publicly available in Chicago is much more bare bones. So we require more, but a significantly smaller number.
You're right that outside income that officers receive helps create a disconnect between the department leaders and rank-and-file officers.
Well, you know, the rank-and-file officers have been fighting for years to get a new contract. I mean, they just got one this year. There's long been a sort of gripe that this is an incredibly expensive city to live in. And you look outside in Long Island, for example, and the cops are making a bundle more than they're making within the city. And then you've got sort of some of these top officers who are making, some of them were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in side ventures.
Many of them make outside money in the test prep industry. How does that work?
So if you are a rank-and-file officer and you want to move up, you want to take the civil service exam for, say, to become a sergeant, what there is this whole industry of courses, prep material, lectures to help you prep for the test, and it is run by largely current and former officers. And I mean, the former makes sense, but the current, they're the bosses are basically charging the rank and file for help passing these exams.
How much do these test prep classes cost?
They can be $700, $900, $1,000 for the courses plus all of the materials, and they pack them in. I mean, people who want to sort of pass these exams feel they will sort of give them an edge. And so, you know, I found some of the folks who actually own these companies, active duty individuals, you know, some years they were reporting making in the neighborhood of $500,000.
Wow. Just on test prep. Just but you say prep. That the rank and file who want to move up, they see taking these courses as perhaps giving them an edge?
Certainly. I mean, you know, some of it makes perfect sense, right? Like you think of it as SAT prep. How many high school students would take an SAT prep course in the hope of, you know, getting an edge, getting an advantage, getting, you know, if it helps you with one question on the test, is it worth it? You know, I did speak to some officers who there is a suspicion or a belief, perhaps unfounded, but there is a belief that, you know, maybe some of these instructors have inside knowledge of what'll be on the test. And so
they pass them on.
Well, you know, that is the suspicion, right? I mean, there is the civil service system here in New York. The tests are supposed to be written sort of confidentially. No one's supposed to know what's on it. You know, in theory, these instructors are not supposed to know what is on the exam. And the ones I talked to, they say, oh no, we don't know. But you know, I did find, there was a captain who was, you know, a longtime instructor and involved in one of these test prep companies who helped write a test one of these years. And the owner of the company said, oh, you know, he at that time he sort of stepped away and he had nothing to do really with helping the students that year. But, you know, it certainly would appear to feed into the perception.
And if I were somebody who was ambitious, I might see that there would be a disadvantage if I didn't at least avail myself of these opportunities.
And I think those are some of the core questions about why this might be a conflict of interest. Is this a conflict of interest? And if so, why? And I think the point you raise, I mean, to what extent are rank-and-file officers feeling pressure, feeling like if they don't pony up this money to some of these active duty guys, that they are going to be sort of maybe missing out on a career opportunity?
I'm speaking to WNYC's Robert Lewis, whose series NYPD Inc. is running currently. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How many stories do you think you're going to have in the near future?
There should be more. I don't know. I'm sort of going where the reporting takes me, and it's fascinating. You know, one of the things I was struck by as I started in on this is just how little there appears to have sort of been looking at these sort of outside financial interests, and there's probably a lot of reasons for that. But yeah, it seems like a very unmined field.
Are there some cops who know about this and come to you with stories?
Certainly, you get tips and sources.
Your latest story focuses on NYPD Assistant Chief Edward De La Torre, who works in Staten Island. What did you learn about his sources of outside income?
So, I did an initial story in November on this assistant chief. I found that I sort of dubbed him as having the most entanglements of any of these top officers in the department. He owns a private security company. He's done business, bought properties with local business leaders, rents space in one of those buildings to a politician, an state assemblyman.
He also maintains an office there, doesn't he?
Exactly.
It gets complicated.
Yes, it gets quite complicated. And he purchased two properties of a missing loan shark at a slightly below market rate from the guy's grieving daughter while the department was still investigating, before the guy had been declared dead. So that was what I initially found in November, and I was ready to move on with my life. And then for a variety of reasons, sort of by accident, actually, I stumbled on the fact that I probably missed in that story the most interesting thing, which was that he scooped up some mob-owned, mob-connected properties after the feds crippled the Bonanno crime family.
Now, the Bonanno crime family is all over the city. Are we talking mostly about Staten Island here?
We're talking about the Bronx. So
the Bronx.
He's a Bronx guy, longtime Throgs Neck resident, has a lot of deep ties to the Bronx. He is currently the top cop on Staten Island, but he's only had that position for a few years.
And is the Bonanno crime family still an active force in the city?
The mob has been greatly reduced in sort of size and I guess ability, one might say,
because they testify against each other.
Well, despite
the rules of the mafia.
There have been a lot of reasons put out there for why that is. Certainly I've also talked to individuals that say they are still a presence in a number of different places. The ports have been thrown out as sort of one of the last, I think, cookie jars or candy jar was the term I'd seen. So, I don't think I don't think anyone would dispute that they're not what they were. But everyone I've talked to, they're not gone either.
What about the construction and real estate industries? Are they still popular places for mobsters to put their money?
I spoke to Jerry Capisi, who writes the Gangland News website, is, considered probably the foremost expert on the mob in a lot of ways. And he says, even in 2017, if you start looking into construction, you don't have to dig too deep to see at least some trace of the mob.
Isn't one of the properties that De La Torre owns a place where the mob used to hold induction ceremonies?
Yes, that was actually one of the fun little tidbits I found in researching the story. So one of the properties he purchased is 239 Robinson Avenue, and that home or the property, the original home has since been torn down, but that property was owned by the mother of Dominic Sicali, who was a convicted murderer and actually testified against the acting boss at the time. And in trial testimony, he sort of talks about how that house, the house on that property, rather, was specifically used for some of these induction ceremonies where they'd sit around with like a candle and a knife and pins and saints and sort of, basically take an oath, swear allegiance to the family.
So it's like joining the Knights of Columbus or the Masons.
I'm unfamiliar with the Masons' ceremonies, but
well, I just meant those kinds of organizations.
Right.
You have secret ceremonies.
Yes.
Didn't you speak to Dominic Sicali?
I actually did. He called me yesterday after the initial story ran. It was fascinating. He has a lot of gripes, sort of complaints about the bank, actually. The bank, which is at the center, at the heart of a lot of Chief De La Torre's real estate dealings, is Ponce de Leon Federal Bank. It's a small Bronx-based bank that I found was a big lender on mob-connected properties or projects, rather, in the early 2000s.
Does anyone know whether the bank actually has explicit ties to the mob or just is willing to lend money to mobsters that maybe other banks might feel uncomfortable lending money to?
You know, I think it's an important point to say that there have been no official allegations. They haven't been sued. They haven't been prosecuted. There has been nothing suggesting that they are, in fact, a mob bank.
How did the loans that Ponce de Leon Bank gave to the Bonanno crime family end up being held by De La Torre?
So there was an 8-unit apartment building in the Bronx on 217th Street that was owned by Dominic Sicali, as well as the wife of Vincent Bassiano, Vinnie Gorgeous, who was the acting boss of
I love the names they gave themselves.
I could have spent 8 minutes probably just saying names in this piece. But it was owned by this sort of firm that they had. And after these guys were arrested, the loan goes into default, and it's a mess. The bank was in court for years sort of trying to get it off its books. Sicali, who was behind bars at the time, was basically alleging that the bank was sort of fraudulently trying to take the properties that he sort of worked with them while he was on the street. And as soon as he got put away, they were trying to sort of basically take his properties. That's what he alleged both on the phone to me, but also in court filings. And in March 2011, this sort of mystery investor with the bizarre name of the Chen Wang Realty Corp swoops in and buys this defaulted loan from the bank. And so they become essentially the new creditor. And then there's about 6 months later in September 2011, there's a foreclosure auction where Chen Wang then takes the property back. And I sort of pieced together that Chen Wang was owned by Chief Edward De La Torre's wife. And then later she then transferred the property from Chen Wang to an LLC that he was involved in.
So they gave it a Chinese name just to cover up the connection?
I have no idea. I asked his attorney that very, very explicitly if they were trying to sort of cover their tracks or something. And he said he did not know the origin of the name.
I've wondered when I heard this story first why you would get your wife involved. Wouldn't that send up all sorts of red flags?
Well, the
I mean, I would want to get some distant cousin, perhaps, and who I had an arrangement with.
Well, I mean, of course, that's assuming they did anything wrong. The what the lawyer has said is that she is a very sophisticated real estate investor. She is a licensed real estate broker. She clearly does work in sort of real estate and invests in properties. And so, you know, what his attorney, you know, says is that, look, there was nothing wrong with this. She's always looking for distressed properties in the Bronx in particular. These came up. They were a very good investment opportunity. They were dealing at arm's length with the bank. They weren't dealing with the mobsters. And so they decided to sort of pull the trigger and go on it.
And who's the legal owner of these properties now?
Well, currently they're owned by LLCs in which the assistant chief, Edward De La Torre, is a partner.
And they are obviously money-making properties.
They would appear to be. There's one is an 8-unit apartment building which has tenants. The other, the one on 237, 239 Robinson, appear to have tenants in them. Two of them, some of the other property, one of the other properties hasn't been built, hasn't been developed, but.
Did De La Torre and his wife get a good deal on these former Bonanno properties?
It appears that they did.
Make us suspicious?
Well, you know, if that's it certainly would appear to be something that's worth looking at, and I would imagine to the extent that there's an investigation of these deals, there will be some look at what the bank, the terms that the bank gave, and the degree to which they were able to get a good deal from the bank.
The reason I ask is anyone who has tried to buy property in New York in the last few years knows that even some of the most depressed properties are incredibly expensive. We've seen major inflated prices all throughout the city.
I would certainly imagine that the terms and prices in these deals is something that investigators will look at. And I would say that, you know, when they bought the loan, for example, they bought the loan on the, you know, apartment building, the terms of that are not public. So we don't know what they actually paid for this defaulted debt. The three lots that they own on Robinson, it was a defaulted $990,000 loan for this sort of development construction. They purchased these properties for, I believe it was $375,000 from the bank.
My guest is Robert Lewis of WNYC. He is a George Polk Award-winning reporter, and his series, NYPD Inc., is creating a lot of waves. We will find out some more about what he has uncovered after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Robert Lewis. We're talking about the series that he has been broadcasting on our news shows here. It's called NYPD Inc. And how did you wind up on this beat?
So I was actually out on leave, paternity leave, when news broke last spring of a major corruption scandal, an investigation, not only into sort of politicians and business leaders, but also into some high-ranking officials within the NYPD. And when I got back, my editor had sort of asked me, what can we do? Let's get into this. And there had been a small scoop early on where someone had pulled the financial disclosure filings of the chief of department, Philip Banks, who was named as at least being looked at in this. He hasn't been charged with anything. And that showed that he had received a bundle of money from a businessman who was also at the center of this probe. And it just got me thinking, like, does anyone actually look at these disclosure forms outside of, you know, sort of a breaking news event? And so that kicked it off. I started trying to figure out, well, how do you even get them? And it's this willfully difficult process to sort of get them. And I spent the next several months basically accumulating 6 years worth of these forms and digging into them.
And then developing whistleblowers?
You know, I really did not have many whistleblowers for this story. I mean, this was very heavily based on public records. Mm. I mean, this really I certainly have sources, but I used the disclosure forms and then dug deeper using court filings, real estate records.
One of the concerns some people have had about the shrinking of print journalism especially is that now, with fewer reporters covering local stories, this kind of thing just goes unnoticed. And yet it's really important.
You know, I in some ways have been surprised at the amount of praise, I guess I would say, or the good response to the stories, in part because this is such a basic type of quote-unquote investigative story that you would think you'd see from every newsroom. You know, it's financial disclosure forms. What's in the financial disclosure forms? Someone pulls them and you look and see what they say. And I don't know why it really hasn't been done on any broader scale. I mean, it is the system we have here in the city does make it very difficult to get them, but you raise a very good point.
Well, the George Polk people appreciate what you do. A listener, Stephen from Highland Park, New Jersey, asks on our show page if you've received any threats because of your reporting.
I have not. I had one NYPD press officer threaten to throw me out of a turkey giveaway after the first story ran. He might have been joking, but that's the closest I've received.
Didn't the Department of Housing Preservation and Development file a complaint in Bronx Housing Court about one of De La Torre's properties?
Yes, one of the apartment buildings he bought that had been owned by the loan shark, they was actually in what the city calls the alternative enforcement program. It's basically means that the conditions are so bad the city has the right then to go in, fix them, and then charge the owner. And so they did file a complaint.
Can potential conflicts of interest arise if a police chief is acting as a landlord?
One would imagine they could. I mean, you know, certainly the argument I've heard from the PD is sort of, you know, why it's sort of ridiculous to think that an official couldn't own property. I mean, how onerous are we going to make these restrictions on outside investments, outside income? You know, we're just going to lose people. And you know, it's a compelling argument. And,
well,
and
the
it
mayor's
certainly
also
makes a
landlord.
Certainly. And so, you know, some of it depends on how individuals conduct themselves.
But the stories you're telling seem to me would be sending off all sorts of alarm bells in the Department of Internal Affairs, because some of these lines are rather hazy.
I would think so.
In fact, one of you mentioned deleterious tenants is Democratic State Assemblyman Michael Benedetto. Has he commented on the arrangement?
He said Delatorre is a good landlord, and it says they just have a business relationship. They keep sort of personal separate from business, and it was a good location, central to his district, and so he's been happy with the arrangement.
How did Delatorre acquire that property that he leases to Benedetto? Didn't he pay close to nothing for it?
Well, so he originally purchased – there was an LLC, including Delatorre, as well as the owner of a local newspaper, currently the chief of staff to Benedetto, who they purchased it as members of this LLC. And then at a later date, this chief of staff basically signed over his share of the property to Delatorre for what appears to be $0. It is unclear.
$0 is really cheap.
yes. So it is unclear, you know, necessarily why and all the terms and whatnot, or if there were other terms. But the public record seems to suggest no money was paid.
And Delatorre is working out of the Benedetto property. So is there a quid pro quo here?
I'm not prepared to say that necessarily, but I found him working out of there rather by accident. I had been going by the property, you know, looking who the tenants were, and went in the office where the sort of real estate operations were, and had intended to sort of leave a business card and asked some, you know, nice person sitting at the front desk, oh, does the chief ever come in? And they said, oh yeah, he's in back. And it was a Monday afternoon, and so I had a chance to meet him.
Do we know if the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau has investigated Delatorre's actions?
Well, so the story on his purchase of the mob properties came out yesterday, and our City Hall reporter Bridget Bergen asked the commissioner at an unrelated press conference, and he said that in response that he had a conversation with the Deputy Commissioner of Internal Affairs, and they have opened an investigation.
My guest is Robert Lewis, who is a George Polk Award-winning reporter. We're very proud of that here at WNYC. And we're talking about what he's learned in his series, NYPD, Inc. Another person that you write about is Vincent Jimmy Durso. Can you tell us a little about him?
Vincent Durso went missing. He was a father, devoted family man, small time loan shark, never charged with anything. Although the documents filed in surrogates court sort of show he did a little bit of money lending on the side. He dropped off his wife's home health aide in April 2010 and was never heard from again. His car was found sort of parked on a side street in the Bronx, and it was a couple of years, just about 2 years after his disappearance, that his daughter sold two of his properties to the chief.
To Delatorre
and Delatorre's wife.
Did the people you spoke to about Durso have any suspicions or hunches about why he went missing?
Nothing. It was speculation. He's never been found. And he was ultimately declared dead. He was declared dead after the chief purchased the properties.
And do we know about the circumstances of that transaction, buying that property from Durso's daughter?
It had to go through surrogates court. She was,
Was he investigating the disappearance?
It does not appear he was. No, I mean, I think that's an important point. There is no implication that he had anything to do with the investigation. There's no implication that he did anything to hinder the investigation. I mean, I have not heard any allegation like that at all. I do think that's an important point to make. What his attorney basically sort of says was that, hey, this was, again, an investment opportunity that just happened to come up, and you know, he didn't even really know who Durso was.
So how much did De La Torre pay for that property?
He paid $800,000. It was for two properties. Paid $800,000. The
is that below market value?
It was as part of the surrogate court filing. There had been sort of a market appraisal, and it had put the value at I believe it was $960,000. And the daughter basically had to get sort of court approval to sell it below. And you know, she was dealing with a lot. She was still grieving the loss of her father, it would seem, and so she just kind of wanted to be done with it.
Did De La Torre buy the property himself or through one of his or his wife's LLC companies?
They bought it again through a corporate entity. Interestingly enough, again, if you look at the actual publicly filed deed, his name is not on it. But he signed the sale contract, which was not publicly filed, at least in the property records, that was included in the surrogate court filings.
If Durso's disappearance was still being investigated, does that mean that his family was financially vulnerable at the time of the sale?
I'm sure someone could make that case, that argument. I don't know.
On the other hand, is this an example of people assuming where there's smoke, there's fire, but there might actually not be any fire?
Well, and that is that's what his attorney would say. I mean, that's what De La Torre's attorney and probably some within the NYPD, at least the ones who were sort of trying to quash this story before it ran, they're investors, and if you dig deep enough, you're going to find connections, and you can make anything seem dirty. But that the chief, you know, doesn't have anything to do with organized crime. His wife is a savvy real estate investor.
Is it possible that De La Torre bought the properties without even knowing about Durso's disappearance?
Certainly possible. They would have had to go through surrogate court, and I mean, there would have been a number of stages along the way where conceivably they would have an opportunity to sort of find out why things were getting delayed. This was a Throgsneck guy who went missing. Throgsneck is a small community. He lives in Throgsneck. It seems to me a little bit implausible that he wouldn't know. This was a big story there when the guy went missing. But that being said, it's certainly possible.
Doesn't De La Torre also own a private security company?
He does.
Successful is that?
It's all Borough Security. I was not very successful in figuring out where exactly they do work. I believe the last time I checked the state filings, they had 19 unarmed security guards on their roster. From some of the stuff I could find online, it looks like they maybe do some work in property buildings, guarding property buildings. But I don't know all of the locations where they are.
But this is not unique to De La Torre. A lot of cops also work as security guards when they're off duty.
Certainly. I mean, I don't know the extent to which active duty officers own security companies or are heavy investors in security companies. Certainly you probably look at the rank and file, you're going to find guys that are maybe working off duty at sort of Yankee Stadium or something. But this seems to be a little bit different.
We recently had the former head of the Internal Affairs Department as a guest on our show, and he said reasonably that most cops are honest, but you can almost guarantee that, like in any other group, there's going to be a few who are going to see this as an opportunity to make some money. Some of them enter the force with that in mind. Some of them, it occurs to them while they're on the force. So it seems to me you're going to have a lot of material for NYPD Inc.
I think you raise an important point there. And I had a conversation with the Deputy Commissioner for Public Information at one point. You know, and he made the point. He said at a certain point, the honor system has to kick in, right? I mean, these are big boys. These are law enforcement professionals. You know, what kind of system do you have to create to catch everything? And how onerous is it? And is it realistic? And, you know, can you legitimately run every client that you know, some cop moonlighting as a real estate agent has through some sort of database to see whether they have any connection? And is that even legal, using police resources, say, to sort of look into the background of someone just because they're doing dealings with an officer? So, I mean, it gets a little slippery as you go down the slope. And also, you know, a big point the NYPD made over and over is that you know, outside employment investments, this isn't unique to the NYPD. This is citywide.
But you said they can't work in bars or as locksmiths. Wouldn't a cop be an ideal bouncer in a bar or a nightclub?
Well, I think it that's where the conflicts of interest potentially come in. Yes, you would think they'd be an ideal person, but you know, being in that situation, who is their loyalty to? Are they fulfilling their duties as
locksmiths?
A law enforcement officer? You know, it has to do with you know. Again, it could be a conflict of interest. You're showing up because someone's house was broken into, and then you're sort of selling them locksmith services. So there's a whole list of jobs they're not allowed to have.
Robert Lewis has been reporting on NYPD Inc. He's received a George Polk Award, and my great thanks to him for being on our show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jessica Zitter practices both critical and palliative care medicine at a hospital in Oakland, California. She routinely uses high-tech equipment to save lives in the intensive care unit, but she also witnesses the profound suffering that those very same tools can inflict on patients who are approaching the end of life. In her book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, she writes about her experiences as a doctor and the choices we all need to make when dealing with a critical illness. The book is published by Avery, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jessica Zitter to our show today. Hello.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me.
Aren't there many doctors in your family?
Many, many.
So going back a couple of generations?
Well, going back to my grandfather and of that generation, my father's paternal grandparents, there were 8 boys and 6 of them were doctors.
Usually that means that the final third generation says, no, I'm going to do something else. What happened with you?
Well, I actually have to think, but yes, I think I'm the only doctor in my generation. And I really wanted to join the legacy. I thought they were heroes.
How does your philosophy of medicine differ from your parents and grandparents? Did palliative care exist during their professional careers?
No, palliative care didn't even exist during the formative parts of my career. It's a really new subspecialty, and it's one that gives a lot of new answers.
Do we as a culture have unrealistic expectations of our medical system that everyone will wind up having a miraculous recovery?
I think since the beginning of time, humans have had a fantasy of perpetual life. And I think the past 100 years or so that have brought the development of fabulous technologies that really have saved lives have given us a distraction and made us sort of believe that death really is beatable.
Well, we hear about the people who have beaten cancer or whatever and just assume that it's possible for us as well.
I think we always feel that there's something that can keep death at arm's length.
And what impact does our fear of death and our tendency to ignore it as a culture have on the end-of-life experience?
I think, like any big thing in life, if you're not preparing for it and being realistic about it and you have your head in the sand, it's hard to really make the preparations that are going to be best for you. And so we end up getting taken by surprise.
There's a lot of talk about a good death. What makes a death good or bad?
I think it's completely dependent on the person. It's very, very unique, and I think that's why it's so critical that we be talking about this so much and getting that out, those details out.
Although we usually ignore it because we find it kind of depressing, and I know that when I announced that we were going to talk about end of life on this show, there were a fair number of listeners who would say, oh, I'm not sure I want to hear that.
I think it's really true that death is sad. I think the idea of an end and a departure and an absence is sad, and I don't think we should deny that. I think it's a part of life.
Some people might see critical care and palliative care as somewhat contradictory specialties. Can you tell us about your dual role?
Yes, and I remember when I first started thinking about palliative care, and it was before it was even an official subspecialty, a friend of the family's who was a chief of medicine at a very prestigious medical school said, I actually think that you're selling your patients a false bill of goods if you're practicing and thinking about palliative care as an ICU doctor, sort of as if that would make me less inclined to save someone's life. And that is just not what palliative care is. I mean, to me, palliative care, which particularly the communication aspect of it, is about enhancing autonomy. It's about giving people choices. It's about not doing things by protocol and reflexive behavior.
So how are the priorities different for these two approaches?
Ultimately, I think they're ultimately in an ideal world, they should be exactly the same. The priorities of both intensive care and palliative care should be to do patient-centered care, to do what's right for the patient, whether it's high-tech treatments or it's maximizing comfort and quality of life.
While critical care physicians focus on maintaining organ function, do they sometimes ignore other symptoms that they might consider less critical?
Yes, and one of the things I learned as I became introduced to palliative care was that, you know, we were not really taught to focus on pain and suffering in the intensive care unit, particularly because sometimes we think, well, pain medications or sedation medications can lower blood pressure, and blood pressure sort of for us the holy grail, keeping someone's blood pressure up. And so there were many times that I wasn't treating pain or suffering because I thought I really needed to prioritize the blood pressure.
Can palliative care help with symptoms like nausea, which won't shorten your life but can make someone quite miserable?
Absolutely. There's such a huge success rate that we have as palliative care practitioners in managing symptoms of all sorts for patients who are very seriously ill. And it's a delight to practice and to have those skills to help manage those symptoms for people.
But when you're also saying that in many cases a doctor will hear a complaint about one thing and say, well, this is not all that important. What we really should be focusing on is that other thing, and wind up ignoring something important.
You mean ignoring something physiologically?
Physiologically, or something that might also be a clue to a different or more serious kind of problem.
In my experience, I have never felt a contradiction in managing, suffering and saving lives. I really haven't had that experience at all. I think it's something we can pull in and do all at the same time. And I really advocate that and think it's important.
You've called your book Extreme Measures. What are the extreme measures that you're referring to there?
That title actually has a double, almost a triple entendre. The first is when you think extreme, you think hero and let's do this and we can save lives and sort of that ICU meaning. But extreme also can mean too much. It can mean extreme in the negative sense. And I obviously, is reflected in my book, you can see that a lot.
Do we get unrealistic views of CPR from watching TV medical dramas?
Absolutely. There was actually a study, I think it was in the New England Journal in 1994, that showed, you know, the incredible sort of, first of all, unrealistic projection of life-saving and expectations that you can get from these types of heroic procedures. And then really there's this incredible sense that the people really are getting all of their information from this media, which is just not true. It's not portraying a true reality.
Well, the doctors are the heroes of those shows, and the happy ending is what's preferred. Do any TV shows get it right?
You know, I don't watch a lot of TV, but I have to say, I feel like of the TV shows I've seen, ER got it a little bit more right than a lot. But most of my colleagues and friends, I would venture, are going to agree with me that it's not, these are not realistic portrayals of what happens in an ICU.
I guess we shouldn't expect it from TV in general. I used to work in advertising, and I couldn't watch Mad Men because it was just so unlike what really went on.
That's interesting because I love Mad Men, and when I talk to other people who are not doctors, they love Grey's Anatomy, and Grey's Anatomy makes me chuckle.
Why do life support treatments so often cause pain and suffering when they're supposed to be helping the patient?
When someone is dying, when someone's seriously ill, critically ill, there's a lot of pain and suffering to go around. And these machines can add to it. You put a tube into someone's chest to help them breathe, and that's in and of itself causes suffering. But for someone who has the ability to come back and go back to life, I think we would all say that it's probably, to that person, if you talk to them, worth doing. Mm. And certainly we have the treatments and the medical treatments to keep the suffering and anxiety down, which we really are obligated to do as ICU doctors. But it's when you talk about using them on patients who have very little to no chance of recovering, whose underlying disease is so advanced, people with terminal illness, terminal cancers, who probably won't benefit from them, that's when it's non-beneficial suffering.
And that's when we come into all sorts of issues that we're going to talk about in just a moment. My guest is Dr. Jessica Nutick-Zitter, Zitter. Her book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, is published by Avery. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Tell us about your first code blue for an elderly patient when you were a medical student.
I was actually in my internship year. And it was a red flag moment, and I was able to sort of sublimate it later and go on, but it was a moment where I was so excited. It was code blue. It was my first time to actually, as a resident, as an actual doctor, practice my life-saving tools, and I came in thinking, who's this person going to be? You know, code blue, 11th floor, and we're running up, and I think it's maybe a man with a heart attack or a pregnant woman with a blood clot, and we're going to save this person and be heroic. And when I ran into the room, this person was really close to death from terminal illness, had been sick for years with no, you know, the body was completely brittle and broken down. And we just did this aggressive code for about a half an hour, and it was grueling and grisly to watch and certainly to be a part of.
Do you feel that you helped this patient in any way?
Not at all. Not at all. I think we battered this patient's body before this patient left the world. And I think everyone in the room knew that this wasn't going to help.
But that was the expected protocol at the time?
Protocol. It's just protocols. And we're just following our protocols.
How did that experience begin to change your views about the way that you wanted to be an effective doctor?
That moment.
But this is very early in your career.
Yeah, it was really early. And I remember that moment because it was so distressing. But what I do also remember is how I sublimated it for 10 years. It would take another 10 years until something clicked and I realized, oh my goodness, this really isn't feeling right to me. Because I did this over and over again for 10 years. And I happened to be lucky enough to be at University Hospital in Newark, New Jersey, when they had this wonderful grant that was a very rare and unique grant several years before palliative care became a formal subspecialty. And there were all these people in place there trying to enhance communication in the ICU. And I was just lucky enough to be there and learned another way. And that's, I had a substitute, another approach. Before that, for those 10 years prior, I had no other way of treating patients.
So what are some of those recent advances in critical care?
Oh, you mean for life-saving?
Well, or just how would you have changed the way you would have dealt with some of these people over that 10-year period? Mm-hmm. Just ignored the fact that, just said, okay, let them die?
No. What I needed was words. I needed to learn how to talk to people and to break bad news. Because one of the things that we do, it's not just that we're using protocols. Protocols have a place. I think protocols are really great for really rescuing people from death when, you know, just boom, 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 this is what we do. That's great. What we weren't doing, what hasn't been done, is doing these things with informed consent, with really, truly establishing, explaining what the burdens and the benefits are, telling people what their prognoses are so that they can have an input into whether or not they want to or do not want to accept these very high-tech treatments.
Although it gets complicated because then family members get involved.
Right. And that's why it's so critically important that we have these conversations more upstream than the intensive care unit, because the intensive care unit, first of all, is a very emotional and stressful place to be, and there's so much chaos and anxiety and things happening. And more importantly, the patient usually can't speak for him or herself. And then it is left to families, loving families, people who care, but in this moment where there's just so many different ideas, and it's hard to really activate what the patient wants.
And you write about disagreements within families. One person says, do everything you can to keep mom alive, and the other one says, she's in pain, let her die.
Right. It's painful to watch. It's painful to see that kind of distress happening in families, and most of the time it's really well-meaning people just trying to figure out what the best thing is to do, and they've just never had a conversation before, and they don't know what the mother or the father would want.
But you also say doctors are reluctant to tell patients bad news, mm-hmm. and family members as well?
To tell the family members?
Yeah. Just be the conveyors of bad news?
Absolutely. I think it's really, it's a multifactorial problem. There's so many reasons why bad news isn't being transferred back to the people who need it. Among them, you know, we don't know the words. We're afraid of emotion. We are terrified of uncertainty in medicine. And we just sort of get paralyzed and say, well, let's just keep treating.
Well, what happens if you tell somebody, really, you know, there's nothing we can do right now. Sorry. You probably are going to die. Some people take that well. I mean, if you do say it, some people take it well. Others really freak out.
Yes. It can go a whole number of ways. Just like there's so many different types of people and family systems in the world, there's so many different types of reactions to bad news. But it's our responsibility as doctors to stand with those emotions and be able to still, in a compassionate way, deliver the message that we need to deliver.
Isn't more than one conversation needed during the course of a long illness in order to not only to reassess the goals of the care, but also perhaps to prepare the people involved?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's why palliative care and the training that we get in terms of communication is so helpful, because you don't just come in and slam somebody with bad news. It's really, you know, and sometimes we don't really know where things are going. So it's this idea of working as a team and being compassionate and maybe sending out what we call a warning shot and really, you know, bringing people into the conversation, allying with people, being emotionally supportive of them, and creating a team so that we can help them process whatever is coming along the path.
Do you think that the medical education system shortchanges doctors by avoiding even addressing these subjects?
I think it's changing. I think I've just been witnessing in my own, just in the past few months even, in my hospital, just this incredible interest in starting to educate medical students and residents about how to have these skills. My mantra is, these are just as important skills, these communication skills, as learning how to do a code or put in a catheter.
Well, part of the problem, I imagine, is also thinking about the way the patient and the families are going to make it difficult for you to be truthful about conveying bad news.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there was a study that came out that interested me a lot a few months ago in JAMA that showed that patients and families rate doctors much higher on a likability scale who give good news than those who give bad news. So it's a two-way street, this honesty issue. It's not just the doctors aren't giving it. It's also how is it received? And when doctors want to be like too, so we've all got to work together to process reality.
A listener has called in to ask if you could explain the difference between palliative care and hospice care.
That's great. To palliate means to cloak. It's the Latin verb palliare, and that really is what palliative care is about. Its focus is on managing symptoms and cloaking and supporting patients with whatever symptoms, be they spiritual, be they anxiety, be they nausea. And that could be a patient who's not dying at all. I mean, there's many patients who will benefit from palliative care. Hospice utilizes the principles of palliative care for patients who are dying and is often delivered in the home environment. In fact, I think the latest data I've seen is that 80% of hospice treatment is delivered at home and with palliative care nurses and medical doctors managing the case in a patient's home.
Although there are places where people go for hospice care as well. Is this a new specialty?
Well, the hospice movement really got started in earnest in this country. I believe it was in the 80s when, you know, in response to the AIDS epidemic and managing and supporting patients who were dying of AIDS. But it's definitely getting more and more well-received, and it has tremendous high satisfaction and wonderful outcomes for patients.
People are calling in, and I guess we have touched on a subject that is important to almost everyone, so they probably have all sorts of questions they want answered. You can call us at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.com. leonardlopate.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We will come back with some of those calls and, of course, also talk about other things that Dr. Jessica Zitter talks about in her new book called Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. It is published by Avery Books, and Dr. Zitter is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, The Atlantic, and other publications. She was also featured in the award-winning Netflix documentary, Extremis. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Dr. Jessica Nudick Zitter. Her book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, is published by Avery. And a lot of people have been calling in. Maybe we should take a few of those calls. We will go to Emily first. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi. My mom was staying with us about 12 years ago when she had an attack that landed her in the ER at a local hospital in Westchester. And she was she knew she had an aortic aneurysm, and it was probably the aneurysm dissecting, although we never knew for sure. In the emergency room, the doctor asked me, do you want your mother treated? And I said, well, why don't you ask her? And she said, absolutely not. I'm an old woman. I'm ready to die. I just don't want to be in terrible pain. And she signed the DNR because she was in a different state. She was up from Virginia. And I stayed with her till they threw me out after 11 o'clock at night. And in the morning when I called, they said, oh, her blood pressure plummeted. They put her on dopamine, I think, and she's up in the ICU. And I went to the ICU to see her and held her hand, and she said, Emily, I'm ready to die. I just don't want to be in terrific pain. And we thought that was it, but I'm sure had she had her druthers, they wouldn't even have treated her for the blood pressure. But apparently signing a DNR does not preclude being treated for other things other than your heart stopping, I guess.
Dr. Zitter, you're nodding your head.
Yeah.
And she ended up surviving that, whatever it was, coming home and with hospice care after 13 days in the hospital. And it was a very sweet time for us, for the most part, until she was really ready to die, and she was just begging anybody who would help her to die.
I'm so sorry. It sounds like, well, it was a very difficult experience.
It was difficult, and it was also sweet at the same time, but I know for her, well, she probably would have dropped dead in her garden in Virginia, but mm-hmm. failing that, she would have not been treated at the time that she was in the hospital.
Right. So here's what I would say. Here's what I would say. I think what it comes back to is basic principles, which is we really shouldn't be talking about medicine as a cafeteria plan. We should be going much higher level and talking about goals of care. And it sounds so clear to me that your mother's goals of care were keep me comfortable. Let me be at home with my family, which clearly you were lucky enough to get that time. But the ultimate decisions about dopamine or not dopamine or this or that, those things, which you're right, are not covered under a DNR, usually, should really not be in her decision or your decision. It should be focused on maximizing the quality. And that is something that we fall prey to as doctors a lot. We get into this whole cafeteria vending machine plan. Well, do you want the dopamine or do you not want the dopamine? Do you want us to use this other, you know, antibiotics or not? It really shouldn't be getting down to that level of in the weeds.
But since she had signed a DNR, a do not resuscitate order, shouldn't they have just honored that?
Well, they did. I mean, there are many different things on a DNR. DNRs are also a cafeteria plan. You know, do you want to be intubated? Do you want to have pressors? Do you want to have, you know, antiarrhythmics? Do you want to have blood pressure support medications? And there's a whole bunch of different things that are checked. And so they may have not unchecked, you know, dopamine.
Uh-huh. Well, do you recommend a medic alert DNR bracelet?
If someone is very, very clear that they do not, that their priority is maximizing comfort and quality of life and that they don't want to spend time in the hospital, for example, which clearly your mother did, and that may have been something that went against her wishes ultimately, then I think it is appropriate for people to get a medic alert bracelet that's an out-of-hospital DNR.
What is a physician order for life-sustaining treatment, a PULSED?
A PULSED is essentially an out-of-hospital DNR, and it's a form that looks just like the DNR that we sign in the hospital, but a DNR that's signed in the hospital is only good for that admission on that particular in that particular hospital. A PULSED is something that can cross state lines if the state, if the same, the other state accepts PULSED forms, and it's a legitimate doctor's order saying do not resuscitate this patient.
So if you sign a DNR and go to a different state, they won't necessarily honor it?
Well, it depends. Again, if it's a PULSED, if it's the official, you know, physician order for life-sustaining treatment, they will honor it. That is a legal doctor's order that can follow you from state to state.
If you have filled out an advance directive, is it necessary to have a PULSED as well?
Yeah, yes, it is. An advance directive is not a legal order from a doctor saying do not intubate this patient, do not use antiarrhythmics. It's not an official doctor's order.
Many people are reluctant to write ADs. Why? Well, I mean, what do you think accounts for that? And you also found differences in races and ethnicities in completing the AD.
You know, why do people not create? I have a friend who's a trust and estates lawyer, and she and I share stories about people's avoidance of wanting to either talk about death or talk about processing their estate if they die. There's a lot of sort of aversion to this topic, both in the medical and in the legal world.
Well, since many advance directives are written years before the patient actually gets sick, aren't there cases where their wishes may have changed?
Absolutely, and that's a really important point.
You write about a patient named Vincent.
Oh, yes. Vincent is somebody I'll never forget, who I took care of at University Hospital in Newark, who had come in with an advance directive that he had signed 10 years before I met him at a nursing home, and he had actually said, do everything on his advance directive. I want everything to be done to prolong my life no matter what. And then he had actually handwritten, again, 10 years earlier, a letter that said, please, please, you know, any doctor taking care of me, do everything you can to prolong my life. And he had underlined everything. But by the time I met him, he had no one to speak for him. He was an unrepresented patient, as we call him. And he was so sick and had been on a trach, you know, attached permanently to machines for several years. And he was so sick and debilitated that he actually was in profound pain. And it was gruesome in a way that's described in the article, and I won't necessarily go into that now, but I really wondered, and I can't know for sure at all, if his wishes that he had so clearly stated would still be the same had he known what it was going to look like to get this sick.
If a patient has a DNR, does that mean he can't get surgery?
Well, that's a tricky, tricky topic that's really currently being debated, actually, in the American College of Surgeons. There's a lot of question about this. In fact, there was just an article that came out, and I haven't read it yet because it just came out, about this topic. And there's a lot of disagreement about what happens. When patients have a DNR, doctors, surgeons sometimes are more reluctant to take them out to surgery because they feel that this person's saying, I don't want to be resuscitated. And if something goes wrong on the operating room table, they feel that their hands are tied. And so it's a really complicated topic that I think warrants more conversation, but probably more than we can talk about right now.
We have a lot to talk about. We don't have a lot of time, actually. Dr. Jessica Nudick-Zitter is my guest. Her book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Let's take another call. Robert from Monroe, New Jersey, you're on the air.
You know, Lenny, this is a really excellent topic, and you're doing an excellent job in interviewing and allowing the person to talk about it.
Well, she's a good guest.
Yeah, and I think every family now in the 21st century is being affected by this. My specific question to the guest is, we had a situation in our family where we had a meeting and the patient didn't really want to go on. She had stopped wanting to eat, but she was healthy enough really to survive. And we had a meeting with a psychiatrist. His wife was a person who ran a nursing home and was a head nurse at a nursing home. My father, myself, and my sister, and everybody felt that we should just allow her to die with dignity, but one person did not. And to honor that person's wishes, we went with that person, and allowed, he kept the person alive, and the person survived for a number of years afterwards. The point is, I was curious from the guest standpoint, how do you deal with that when you have a group of family members and people making decisions, and one person disagrees, yet the majority feels another way?
You've written about that.
How do you feel that should be handled?
It's so, again, so unique, and so each each situation requires a whole different approach, because ultimately it's all about the patient, and it's all about trying to get to the truth of what the patient would want. The patient is the person who has to be most respected in this, and you know, if there was any evidence that the patient had said, "I wouldn't want this," then allowing the care to be dictated by this one person, I think, might be difficult.
In writing about end-of-life conveyor belt, I was wondering whether shouldn't a distinction be made between relatively young, relatively healthy trauma patients who will be more likely to recover, and frail, chronically diseased, and the dying?
Absolutely. The end-of-life conveyor belt term only applies when you're using these treatments by protocol without having discussed it on patients who are very unlikely to benefit from them, whose underlying disease is not likely to benefit. I would argue that for a young and healthy person who has some trauma or something acute happen, using anything, you don't need to necessarily, if you don't have time, get informed consent from patients who have a really good chance of benefiting from it. But for those who are really sick and terminally ill, I think the end-of-life conveyor belt concept applies if you're using them by protocol without having discussions.
So giving somebody a tracheotomy, for example, and when they're 90 years old and in very bad shape, that is just a useless kind of thing?
No, I wouldn't even say that. I would say I would not call that the end-of-life conveyor belt if that decision is completely the result of long-standing conversation and true informed consent. If that's what that patient really wants, with the understandings of the benefits and the burdens, I don't call that the end-of-life conveyor belt.
Why do you suggest that chronically ill patients visit an ICU before they need to be admitted?
You know, I certainly don't think we can insist on that. I think a lot of times people end up in ICUs unexpectedly, but I think it's just interesting that we take so much time to show, for example, pregnant women, what does the maternity ward look like? What are the things that are going to come your way? What can you expect? And we don't have any of that knowledge for patients when they get sick enough to be in the intensive care unit.
Can the isolation of the ICU be difficult for a patient?
Oh, I think it's very difficult. I think there's a lot of data about the trauma, the PTSD of the ICU experience, and it's a very lonely and isolating place. I see it every single day. I mean, there's machines everywhere. The family feels anxious and intimidated, and frankly can't stand vigil necessarily all that time when the patient is just going day after day after day.
Haven't you taught death ed classes for high school students?
Yes. One of my colleagues, Dr. Don Gross, who is another palliative care physician, and I submitted a proposal to the Open IDEO Reimagine Death Challenge. And we actually, our idea won a top idea. And we then went and I asked my children's school if I could implement this. And we did it at their school. And it was quite surprising how open and responsive the kids were, and participatory and not intimidated.
And then there's a death cafe movement.
Yes, that's another one. There's death over dinner, there's the death cafe movement. Mm. There's a whole lot of ways that people are starting to engage in this conversation.
You've inspired caretakers to call in. One asks, what's the purpose of a BiPAP as opposed to getting a regular little oxygen mask?
BiPAP is actually a tight-fitting mask that goes on the face that pushes air into the body, sort of assists you in the muscle energy of breathing. So it's although it's not an invasive thing like an endotracheal tube that goes into your lungs, it's having the same extra mechanical support effect. Whereas a nasal oxygen tube is just giving a little bit of extra oxygen.
My guest has been Dr. Jessica Nudick-Sitter, who. Well, you work in Oakland. Do you think it's different in hospitals all over the country? Because you've also worked here in this area.
There are different. I worked in a hospital in Newark that was a very similar profile in terms of patient demographic to where I work in Oakland. So I feel that it's extremely similar. But I think if you look in a, go to hospitals where, you know, there's a different profile of patient, then there are different approaches and attitudes. It's very varied, I think, this whole concept.
Dr. Jessica Zitter practices both critical and palliative care medicine at a hospital in Oakland, California. Her book, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, is published by Avery. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.